Good morning and welcome to Education Matters. My name is Allison Erickson and I'm your host today. I'm delighted to be here with you today to talk about family engagement in schools and how all students, including students with disabilities, are better served through active family engagement. Here to talk with us today is Carlene Chavez. Carlene is the Wisconsin Statewide Parent Educator Initiative Family Engagement Coordinator for CESA 2. Her role is to create stronger connections and engagement between schools and families that they serve. Carlene has over 20 years of exploring special education and disability resources as a parent of a young man with autism. I had the absolute pleasure of working with Ms. Chavez this year on a literacy parent engagement series targeted specifically for parents of students with disabilities. Good morning, Ms. Chavez, and welcome to Education Matters. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk today. We'll get started with the side of you that is more business, what you do. Could you tell us a little bit more about the Wisconsin Statewide Parent Educator Initiative?
Sure, absolutely. So the Wisconsin Statewide Parent Educator Initiative is also called, for shortening up, would be WISPE. And we are a grant through the Department of Public Instruction here in Wisconsin. The state of Wisconsin recognized, years ago, the importance of relationships in education. So as a result of that, WISPE was born. The goal is to help families and schools build positive working relationships, leading to shared decision making and thus better outcomes.
All right. For CESA 2, could you explain to our listeners what is CESA 2 and how do they work within the framework of education in Wisconsin?
Of course. So CESA 2 is one of 12 CESAs here in the state of Wisconsin. CESA 2 supports 74 districts here in South Central Wisconsin. CESA stands for Cooperative Educational Service Agency. Our mission at CESA 2 is to improve student learning by expanding the capacity of our diverse school districts. And how we do this is by partnering with districts in such areas as professional development. We can come into your districts and do some in-depth analysis. And one other thing that we do is connecting to resources, connecting the districts to the many resources that are out there. Those are just a few of the things that we do. If you wanted to find out more, you could go to our website, which is CESA2.org.
All right, and I'll definitely put that on our archive webpage for any listeners to go ahead and look at that.
Awesome.
So as far as expanding capacity, what does that mean?
They work closely with the districts and with the staff, educators, administrators to look at their systems and improvements, show improvements. Of course, there's always professional development going on at CESA 2. CESA 2 involves themselves very closely with DPI, and we want to bring what DPI and their mission and their vision and those types of things right down to the educator.
Well, that's brilliant. It's just an excellent resource out there at CESA 2. You're in Whitewater, correct?
Yes, we are based in Whitewater.
Okay, and teachers are able to go to Whitewater for professional development?
Yeah, and what's nice is it's kind of a central location for CESA 2 because we go from kind of that I-94 corridor all the way to the other side of Madison. So we're kind of right in the middle. And very accessible to all the districts in the state of Wisconsin.
That's brilliant. You do work with rural and urban districts then, correct?
Yeah, we have a very diverse CESA. So we have, some of our bigger districts like Madison and Beloit and Janesville. And then we have some really small ones too, like in Western Racine and Kenosha County. There's some very small districts, so it's very nice and diverse. We have a diverse a large diversity in our in the students that are in our schools, so it's very interesting.
And in that diversity, do you see a difference between the needs between the larger districts and the smaller districts?
Yeah, there's a lot of different needs. Some of the smaller districts, some of the larger districts actually have a lot of resources within them themselves. Some of the smaller districts tend to need more help just because, some people in those smaller districts are doing multiple roles. So definitely see a high need in that area. Not that the larger districts don't need us, but we're definitely in tune with the fact that some of those smaller districts may need some additional services.
Right. And those smaller districts do appreciate that. Moving on here, in your role as the family engagement coordinator, you strive to create stronger connections and engagement between schools and families that they serve. How do you go about doing that?
Well, I think, Allison, I think it's really, really pretty basic. It's building relationships. Whether it's coaching a team within the school to do family engagement activities or coaching an individual parent in the process of special education or providing resources for the school districts or for individuals. I think whether I'm working with systems changes through the district or working with an individual on an IEP, I'm really in a great position to kind of provide that outside view or kind of a neutral or unbiased view. We try to stay back and let people come up with their own answers, kind of that coaching view. I think it just is more meaningful to them. But I think it all goes back to really those building those relationships.
Right. And for our listeners that aren't educators, could you go and just explain to us what an IEP is?
Sure. An IEP is short, an abbreviation for Individual Education Plan. And what it is that it's really a student-centered plan. Individual, it's the plan that it is a plan where we take where the student is currently and we figure out goals and where we want to be. And the plan is for a year long. And so it's our best guess at where we can bring this child within the year.
Right. And that's specifically for students with disabilities, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I guess circling back to methods and engagement for families to bring them to school for engagement, is there anything that works specifically well for different families? Let's talk about for rural areas, and then we can go into more urban areas.
Could you be a little more specific?
So what's the best way to get families more engaged in school?
I think it's unique to each district. I think you really have to sit down and analyze what demographics you have out there. Families are really, really busy. And, how are you going to, you have to think about how you're going to reach them. And I think, sometimes it's the hardest ones to reach are the ones that really need it. So it's really easy for me to say, one of the questions that we talked about is what do we do to create stronger connections between home and school? And it's really easy to sit here and go, join the PTO, join the PTA. But when families are, worried about their next meal or worried about how to pay that bill, it goes down on their list.
Right.
So it's really important for school districts to be, really watching those families that are maybe in crisis or maybe harder to reach, or maybe the parents have had a negative association with school through their own experiences. And to really, dig down deep and think about why those parents might not be engaged or might not be there.
That's an excellent way to reach families. And how do schools themselves, you work with CESA too, but do you know the ways that schools actually do identify those families?
I think you really need an in-depth analysis to be done. You know, sit down and you know, troubleshoot that very, very piece. So, okay. Like I said, they're usually the parents that really need the most help.
Right.
So,
have you seen, now this 2019 and everyone has a smartphone, have you seen technology kind of change the way family engagement has been working?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm kind of not upset, but, you know, I wish that my children, you know, they're a little bit older now, and I miss this whole piece, and I see some of the, I think there's like Dojo and a couple other applications out there where families are being interacted with right on their phones. And I mean, what better way? You know, because that, it seems like most people have cell phones, even our families that aren't necessarily very engaged, or everybody has to have a phone nowadays. So, and I see teachers sending out notes or pictures of their kids during class, and you know, I just think it's a great way for families to see what's happening in school and be able to share and talk about what's going on with their children over dinner, right?
Right. It can start that conversation instead of saying, "What did you do at school today?" Mm-hmm. Nothing. You can actually say, "I saw a picture of your writing today. Tell me about that," right?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's just one of those small ways.
It's a better place to start.
Right.
You know, just gives you a better place to start.
Okay. So let's go back to what resources does CISA2 really provide for parents of students with disabilities?
So really my work with CISA2 is on the WISB grant is really what CISA, that's the focus that I have. I think the best way for parents to get help if they need it would be to call our statewide phone support. We actually have a family information and support specialist team through WISB. What these specialists do is they will talk with parents and you know, talk them through an issue they might be having and give them resources. They may send them back to me. If it's something that I can help with through my relationships with the districts, or they may, you know, send them out to some of our great agencies here and organizations here in the state of Wisconsin that are out there to help families, such as Family Ties. We have Family Voices out there. We have Wisconsin Facets. He does a great job educating our parents and our educators. And we also have a great network called the Parents Parent Network. It's where parents can be matched up with another parent who might be going through the same thing. One of the things that I always talk about when I talk about talk to parents is building their people capital. Really finding somebody who is going through the same thing that you are, and you know, kind of walking that path together, because what one parent doesn't know, another might, and what that other parent might know, some other parent might that they might be friends with, and it just really, it's been a godsend to me building that capital when I did. As far as the family information and support specialist team, if parents wanted to get access that support, I have the phone number. It is 1-833-879-7734. Or you could go to our website, which is just simply WISPEI.org. And there's more information on there.
Okay, and I'll definitely add that to our archive page for this show.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. No problem. I had no idea that there was a parent-to-parent network. You often see on technology like Facebook and things like that, where parents are asking for help. Have you ever experienced this? That parent-to-parent network sounds like a dream.
Yes, I wish I would have known about it years ago when my son Michael was was younger. I did find resources in other families. I can tell you right now, I'm not sure how I did it. You know, I don't know how I did it, but I did.
Well, I know you, Carlene. You don't give up, so I can see that happening.
Yeah, you can't be shy.
Yeah, sure. I think that's probably a basis for that. You have to be an advocate for your child, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I tell families this all the time. It's not going to stop at any time soon. So you may as well learn how to be an advocate yourself. I have lots of parents that call me, and they want me to be an advocate on their team. And for obvious reasons, you know, I work with the districts, and I can't be an advocate. And my role is more to coach them and to be advocating for themselves.
And how do you go about doing that? How does a parent become an advocate? If they're, you know, if they're not involved in education, they don't really know where to start, how do they start?
I think they start by learning about the process. I think they start by getting involved any way they can, making sure their voice is heard at the table when they're coming to the table. You know, reach out. One of the hardest things when Michael was diagnosed was reaching out. It took me a long time to do it. It took me months. I knew I should have done it right away as soon as he was diagnosed with autism. But it is scary. It's scary. You don't, you know, making that first phone call and picking up the phone. But once you start doing it, it becomes second hat. You're not afraid to talk to people. You just go and you know what you need. And or maybe you don't know what you need, but you know, you figure it out.
You do. You just have to figure it out from there, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that. And we'll go into a little more detail about your son, Michael, here soon. I have lots of questions for you to share information about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just talk to you about, and we did touch on this a little bit, but why is family engagement and education so important? So we talk about how reading is really important, and me being a reading specialist, of course, I'm going to say that. But we talk about how literacy and curriculum, math, all of that is incredibly important, and that's how your child is going to excel. But could you talk a little bit about how family engagement is important to education?
Well, I think through the work of some of our, you know, family engagement bureaus, like Karen Mapp and Stephen Constantino, their work has shown that, you know, when you get those families involved, it just, the outcomes are better, and you really want them to be partners in the process. So as you and I saw this spring, you know, we worked on, you know, teaching families a little bit more about literacy, and, you know, that piece just will, you know, if what we're doing at school and what we're doing at home are, you know, on the same wavelength and the same path, how much more effective can we be? We really become a partner in that process at that point.
Yeah, a true team. So I want to go back for just a quick second here just to touch on the family advocate portion. Could you talk a little bit about what is a family advocate in IEP team meetings, the individual education plan team meetings for children with disabilities? Like,
so,
what is that role?
You know what? I don't know if I would term it family advocate. I would say the family voice.
Okay.
More. You know, at some points in some districts, it, you know, you do have to have that advocacy, and you know, but I really think it's about everybody coming to the table and, you know, having their voice heard. And as a mom, you know, it's very different, you know, watching IEPs. Like, I get to go attend some IEPs from the outside now where I'm, you know, again, that unbiased, and it's very different.
Right.
I remember as a mom going into IEPs and thinking, gosh, I know exactly what Michael needs. This is what's got to happen. And I, you know, I would express that, and, you know, sometimes, you know, the team had a better idea than I did.
Right.
You know, so I think it's just really bringing that voice, making sure your child's needs and your concerns as a parent are being heard, and making sure that there's a good plan in place to make sure that those concerns are addressed, and that we're keeping that child, you know, moving forward every single year.
Right. There's always the next goal, right?
Right.
So from a family side, what can families do to create a stronger connection between home and school? without the support of a family engagement coordinator, because we weren't all, you know, lucky enough to have you come into our schools. But what can parents do on their own?
Well, I think it's really important to have regular contact with the school, whether your child has an IEP or not. You know, and that might be just conversing or sending an email to your teacher, getting on those applications like Dojo so you know exactly what's going on in the school system. You know, and then there's the normal, you know, things like joining the PTO and the PTA just so you know what's going on. I think it's really important for parents to be present at as many meetings as they can. And for those families who have IEPs, the Department of Public Instruction recently changed the IEP forms. And one of the things that they added was a prompt on family engagement and what the school was going to do to help the family engage in education. And I think as we move towards getting better and better at using this prompt, we need to move to, you know, pushing forward and not making it so like, well, we'll talk with the family once a month or, you know, those types of things. But, you know, for example, somebody with a speech delay and, you know, saying what we're doing in speech and we're going to be, and these are things that the family can do at home to help this child with that speech delay. And being very specific and using that prompt to be very specific about what we're doing and to work in the, you know, in part as partners in the process.
You're right. I love that. So on that IEP form, is it a list? Like, because a lot of the form is checking boxes, right? For that, the family engagement, is it an open-ended question or is it a list?
It's an open-ended question.
Okay.
And I think, you know, I've been talking, when I talk with families and educators, I really am pushing them to use that more intensely and, you know, have some really in-depth conversations and on what that might look like.
Right. I love that because that's a way that all families can get engaged, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So we're going to just take a break here, give you a little break from talking right there, Carlene. Just let you know, you're listening to Education Matters. I'm Allison Erickson. My guest today is Carlene Chavez, and we're talking about family engagement in schools and how all students, including students with disabilities, are better served through active family engagement. Why did you become a family engagement coordinator?
Prior to working for CISA 2, I worked in a medical clinic where our primary patient was a disabled child. And I got to know the parents really, really well. And some of the questions that they came back to me with a lot was about special education. So when I no longer was employed with the medical clinic, it was a great avenue to continue my work helping other families to navigate, you know, the special education maze.
Right. And it is truly a maze, just with the different laws and the paperwork alone is daunting for both educators and parents.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you bring a unique perspective to the role of parent engagement coordinator. Could you tell us a little bit about your son, Michael?
Sure, absolutely. I'd love to talk about Michael. He's my favorite subject. Michael is, he's 22 years old now, so he is out of the school system. He graduated and received his diploma just a year ago. We had a great big party for him. It was a huge undertaking for all of us as a family and all of the support staff that he had within the school. Michael is nonverbal. He has what I would consider very severe autism. So I say if he could do it, anybody can get through school. You know, we just have to work really hard. He also has seizures and a few other medical issues that keep him feeling not so good once in a while. So that's a big piece of the puzzle with him. He is currently living in a house near Whitewater. He has absolute great sense of humor. He loves to laugh. He loves people, but he has a hard time being around people. I always said the party was over somewhere and I was a mile away with Michael because he just couldn't handle it, even though, you know, he really does love people. So his body and his urges sometimes defy him. He used to have the urge to walk out the door and take a walk, and a lot of times that walk took him to Pick and Save, where he had the urge to eat donuts. So every once in a while, I would get a phone call that Michael was at Pick and Save eating donuts, so I'd run over there and make sure I got him. He also had the urge to run into random people's front doors. So we got into a lot of houses where we weren't necessarily invited in, but Michael made his way in, and
Go ahead. When that would happen, would you make friends with the families, or were the police ever called? Did anything like that ever happen?
Usually we just get them and run out. You know, some people were more inviting than other and realized, you know, that there was, you know, something going on, you know, but some people did get upset. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that's because of the trespassing or because they didn't know necessarily what was going on with Michael?
I think they didn't know necessarily what was going on with him. And, you know, this was years ago. He doesn't run necessarily anymore. I'm going to knock on wood right now so he doesn't start it
right,
again.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was, you know, 10 years ago. And really, there wasn't the awareness that's out there now.
Right.
So.
How did you discover that Michael had autism?
So I remember Michael's first birthday. I was noticing some things, and I remember being really upset because Michael didn't want to interact with anybody. He didn't want to open his presents or play with any of his toys. And I remember after he ate his birthday cake, he and I took him into the bathroom, and I remember just sobbing because I knew something was wrong.
Right.
I couldn't put my finger on it, and, you know, of course, I went into that great thing called denial and, you know, kind of pushed it off for a while. But then at 18 months, you know, things definitely took a turn for the worse. He lost any language that he had and he wasn't responding. He wasn't sleeping. And at that point, family members kind of encouraged me to pursue with his pediatrician, and we kind of just started that path at the time, and it took us, he was about 26 months old when we finally got the diagnosis.
And that was through his pediatrician?
Yeah, we started with the pediatrician, and of course, you know, we thought it was maybe he couldn't hear, and we had to see all types of specialists, but, you know, it was pretty clear that, you know, it was autism.
Okay. And then at that 26 months old, what kind of services started for him?
So at 26 months, he was diagnosed, and they referred us right away to Birth to Three, right?
Okay.
And so we started with them. And then, you know, one of those phone calls that I had trouble picking up the phone to make was to Wisconsin Early Autism Project, where he started receiving ADA at about 2.5, I would say. Then we did 4.5 years of behavioral interventions with him in-home as well.
Okay. And that ABA, the behavior therapy, could you explain what that is?
It's been a long time since I've explained
that. Well, stretching your brain.
It is a method that of behavioral intervention. It's a method of teaching through repetition and through positive reinforcement.
Okay. So that segues into the next question. Could you talk a little bit about some of the, and there are wide-ranging characteristics, but some of the characteristics of autism spectrum disorders that would necessarily need that applied behavior analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I'm kind of doing this through the lens of my view with Michael in mind.
Yes.
But a lot of these, you know, are across the board. So, you know, I just spoke a little bit of the non-responsiveness that we were seeing. He really wanted solitude and sought out to be by himself. He did a lot of rocking and slapping of his hands. One of the things that was uncontrollable was if there was a wheel around, he was spinning it and spinning. He had a lack of eye contact, and a lot of our kids do as well, which we later found out. He said that when he looks at something, his mind takes a mental picture of it. So if he looks at it too often, it gets to be overwhelming to him. So that's how he explained his lack of eye contact, but it was definitely there. Obviously, there was a lack of social skills for anybody who's running into a random door, and he did not play well, next to or with other children. He definitely had trouble, and a lot of our kids do, following directions. Everything needed to be broken down into go get your shoes, put your shoes on, tie your shoes. It had to be broken down. It couldn't just be go get your shoes on.
Right.
So definitely trouble following multi-step directions.
So that's, it was a lot of processes for Michael, but also processes for you to learn how to really break down all those steps.
Absolutely. You don't think about it until you have to. And, really like getting his shoes and putting them on, that's a multi-step. And you're breaking down your whole day as a parent. You know, that was a big piece also of the applied behavioral analysis. They would help me break those things down. So it was, great to have that as a resource back then.
Right. All right. Thank you for sharing that with us. Could you tell us a little bit about, and you've talked to me before about this, so just keep it general, right? Some of your initial experiences with Michael in school?
Yeah, so I was lucky because I had birth to three help me, transition from birth to three to that first IEP. But as a parent, IEPs are foreign at that point, right?
Right.
Unless
oh my gosh!
Yes.
Unless
you have a child yourself or have another child that might have had an IEP, that first initial IEP is huge, and there's a huge learning curve that goes along with it, right?
Yes, definitely. Just the sheer amount of paperwork and people that are in that meeting talking at you.
Right. It's so overwhelming. And at first I really, it takes a long time to learn your rights and your role there. And we talked a little bit about, bringing, the background of our child into that meeting. But at times you really do have to advocate, right?
Right.
So, I wasn't an educator, so I knew nothing about it. So there's, just a huge learning curve going into that. As far as Michael in a classroom, so the first many years of his education up until seventh grade, Michael was in a secluded classroom, very little access to regular education. When Michael turned when Michael was moving into the seventh grade, we moved, actually physically moved, and the district that we moved to uses inclusion and co-teaching, and Michael finally had real access to the curriculum. And I remember shortly after we moved and got here, he wrote that finally people know I'm smart. So he was able to not articulate through his voice, obviously, because he's nonverbal, but through the things that he did and his attitude and his behavior and how much easier life was for all of us as a family and for him going to school, how important that was to him. He wanted to be with his peers, and he wanted to learn,
and he was capable of learning.
He was very capable. He's very, very smart. And he'll let you know it too.
They all do, don't they? Every kid does.
I knew he was smart by the things that he was doing. He would wait until I wasn't looking to escape from the house, and we would have locks that were supposed to be proof, childproof and everything, and he get through them. He figured everything out. I knew he was smart.
Of course. I'm happy you got that experience with school where he was able to be included in that. Finally,
right? It was life-changing.
Yeah. I want to go back to something that you said, how daunting the IEPs are. And I do just want to reiterate for any parents listening or anyone listening that it's okay in those meetings to say, stop, I don't understand, we need to take a break. It's okay to ask for help in those meetings. The language you're using is too difficult. That's just something that's really important to me that parents know that it's not just yeah, go ahead.
I thank you for bringing that up, and I usually do, and I think about it because a lot of families, you know, they think, oh, we've got this 45 minutes and we have to get this IEP in. And really, no, if you need to come back and have another IEP, you need to advocate for yourself for that. You need to put it out there that, you know, this wasn't sufficient time or, you know, or like you said, if they're using words that you can't understand, have them break it down. We are notoriously bad in education for using acronyms.
Oh, my. And terrible. Yes.
I was using them here today, you know, DPI, IEP. You know, we just go ahead, you know, we get them so ingrained in our minds. But parents need to know that they can stop the meeting and say, please explain that to me. Or if they're talking about a reading level, please explain to me. You know, and please explain to me where my child is relative to other students at his age or her age.
Right.
So,
yep, we do. Yeah. We fall into that trap a lot. My dad's going to thank you for saying that because he used to sit at a kitchen table every day of our lives. He has a wife who's a long time teacher and a daughter who's a long time teacher. And he would often just say, hey, you got to explain it to me. I want to be part of the conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's what it is. Parents need to be part of the conversation, so they need to understand what's going on. So thank you for that, Carlene. Let's switch gears a little bit here. And you talked about some of the behaviors that Michael was displaying where he'd go eat donuts at the supermarket or he'd walk into other houses that weren't his. We oftentimes in the news, we see students with autism spectrum disorders being arrested and sometimes being arrested at school. Why do you think this happens?
You know, I got to first say that it's every parent's worst nightmare,
right?
To see that happen. And, you know, of course, with social media, we see it happening every once in a while now. And it's very scary. You know, and I have had, you know, instances where I've been, the police have been called with Michael, such as him being at Pick and Save. And, you know, when he's gone and escaped and, you know, and some police have handled it better than others. And, just like some staff will handle it better than others. I think it all goes back to, we have to have ongoing education, into autism. I don't think it's a one and done. Autism isn't going away. Disabilities aren't going away. We need to continue educating all partners in the community on how to handle these situations. I think it also goes back a lot to as adults working with these students or our children, we need to do some self-reflection into what's going on. We need to think about our roles. We need to analyze the behavior. We need to figure out triggers. What might be triggering this? A lot of our kids ramp really fast, and they calm down really slow. So it's vital to all involved to really, you know, do that root cause analysis and find out why the ramping up is happening, why the behaviors are happening that might, you know, conclude in, you know, a student or a child having that involvement with police. So, you know, it's we're the adults in this situation. We need to figure it out. We need to figure it out sooner than later.
You're so right. You're excellent. Mm-hmm. When I was doing some research for our talk today, I did see there's actually a lot of resources and a lot of training that our staff, police officers and firefighters are able to complete in working with individuals with autism. So I thought that was incredibly interesting, looking from a lens that's not teaching. That's hard for me sometimes. So that a lot of different districts of police and firefighters are doing that training, so they are becoming more aware of how to handle individuals with disabilities when that does happen. So that's very exciting. I guess, what advice do you have for teachers in schools when working with students with autism or disabilities in general?
Well, I would say take the time initially to build the trust. It's not really any different than you do with any student, but sometimes it takes longer with our students.
Sure.
You know, it just does. I think also remember that just because they aren't giving you what you teach, giving what you teach back, it doesn't mean they don't understand. Michael couldn't necessarily, you know, spit things back out, or, you know, they learned to do alternative assessments with him and different ways to make sure that he was understanding the curriculum. I think it's really important for teachers, again, like I just talked about, to do those root cause analysis for behaviors, really getting down to what is the crux of those behaviors, why they're happening. And I think most importantly for teachers and for families and for everybody involved is to always have high expectations. You know, our kids rise.
Right. High expectations are so important for all of our kids. So we're coming down to the end of our questions here. One important one that I want to ask is, as a parent of a child with a disability, what do you struggle with most?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, it's always a learning curve, no matter where you're at, because you keep transitioning. Even now at 22, there's transitions that are going on with Michael, and the transitions are tough. And the more you can stay on top of it or ahead of it, the better off you're going to be. I think a big struggle that I've seen, especially as I'm moving into adulthood with Michael, and is the lack of cohesiveness between our agencies. You know, we need to work together, and there's a lot of red tape that families have to pursue, and you know, they need to never give up on that. And again, I think a struggle that I overcame is building that people capital. You know, it's a struggle to find others in your situation and, you know, build those relationships when you're already taking care of a child that might have, you know, extraordinary needs, not only in schooling, but medical, and you're working with several different agencies just to get services. So those are tough positions, but if you can have a friend or a partner in crime on them, you're going to do much better.
Always helpful to know that you're not alone, right?
Absolutely.
And then just for the last one, in talking about Michael, what's something that you want the outside world to know about Michael or individuals with autism spectrum disorders?
So as far as Michael, he would be so upset with me if I didn't tell people how smart he is. He just wants people to know he's smart. He's 22 years old. He doesn't want to be talked to like a baby. You know, when we are, say, in an emergency room or something, he wants to be talked directly to, right? So I think he would feel like I did him a real disservice if I didn't mention that. I think as far as a general comment, I would just say that just because they can't speak, it doesn't mean they have nothing to say. So if we could just be patient with them and, you know they're smart and know that they want to contribute to society and be a part of everything that normal, safe, normal, you know, in quotation mark.
Right, yeah.
Children, normal students or children would want. So.
Thank you so much, Carlene. I appreciate everything you've said today. And thank you for sharing your personal experiences. I know you have a lot of specific resources you can share with our listeners, so I'll have all those posted on our archive webpage. And thank you so much, Ms. Chavez, for being our guest on Education Matters today. You've been listening to WGTD HD FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of family engagement in schools and how all students, including students with disabilities, are better served through active family engagement is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you so much for listening.